This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, Vanishing Medical Malpractice Cases. Changes in North Carolina's 2011 law has had a chilling effect on medical wrongdoing lawsuits. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. Law takes bite out of medical malpractice suits. In 2011, punitive damages were capped to protect healthcare providers, insurers. This article is written by Jason DeBruin. In Pinehurst, a 27-week premature infant suffered third-degree burns after being left on IV bags overheated in a microwave by hospital staff and left there for more than 10 minutes. The burns caused hemorrhaging, and later bacteria from the burn caused meningitis. In 2000, the family settled with the hospital for $9 million. There are other examples of medical malpractice in North Carolina. A woman died after her colon was perforated during surgery. A newborn was afflicted with quadriplegic cerebral palsy because his brain was deprived of oxygen while his mother was giving birth. An orthopedic surgeon drilled a pin nearly 3/4 inch into a boy's skull. In each of these examples and more, the families involved won a medical malpractice judgment or reached a settlement with the healthcare provider. However, they all happened before 2012. Because of a change in North Carolina law that took effect in 2011, those who have been injured are far less likely to bring a lawsuit against medical professionals. From 1998 through 2010, an average of 560 medical malpractice lawsuits were filed per year in North Carolina. That figure plummeted after the law changed. From 2013 through 2016, the average dropped to 301 per year, a 46% decrease, according to the Administrative Office of the Courts. While rare, medical errors do occur and are sometimes due to physician negligence or failure to adhere to standard practice. The new law caps non-economic damages at $500,000. That means that if a patient is harmed during surgery directly due to negligence by the physician, and a jury awards the patient a judgment of millions due to pain and suffering, the most that victim could receive is $500,000. After that, the patient must pay for the cost of bringing the lawsuit, something that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and pay attorney's fees, which can be as high as 40% of the judgment. With those barriers, it's no surprise fewer victims of medical malpractice are suing, and many attorneys who represent victims say the system isn't fair. Ultimately, it is the public who has suffered by the unfortunate impact of denial of access to the courthouse. There may be less malpractice litigation today, but certainly no less malpractice, says Robert Zaytoun, principal of Zaytoun Law Firm, a Raleigh group that represents victims of medical malpractice. Changes in premiums. The 2011 law that capped non-economic damages received plenty of debate. That year was the first time since 1870 that Republicans held a majority in both chambers of the General Assembly and passed, among other laws, Senate Bill 33, which had the short title, Medical Liability Reforms. Then-Governor Bev Perdue, a Democrat, vetoed the bill but was overridden. The new cap would affect any medical malpractice lawsuit filed beginning October 1, 2011, and lawyers rushed to file complaints before the law change. Indeed, nearly 400 lawsuits were filed in the third quarter that year, more than three times the quarterly average leading up to the law change. In 2012, the lawsuits filed dropped sharply as any backlog had hurried to file in 2011. But by 2013, a clear pattern emerges that the new law effectively reduced medical malpractice cases brought by victims. Supporters of the law change included physicians and insurers that offered medical liability coverage. They argued medical malpractice insurance premiums had skyrocketed and threatened to put physicians out of business. Capping non-economic damages that any single judgment could fetch would bring more predictability to the system and effectively lower premiums, they said. Indeed, that has happened. Total premiums collected by medical liability insurers, which includes health providers like dentists and hospitals in addition to doctors, has decreased 20% since 2011. I will tell you, tort reform has impacted that trend line, says Dale Jenkins, CEO of Medical Mutual Insurance Company of North Carolina, the largest provider of medical malpractice insurance to independent physicians in the state. Bob Seligson, the CEO of the North Carolina Medical Society, the group that lobbies on behalf of physicians, also says the reforms positively affected premiums. The reforms have stabilized the market and premiums, he says. The tort reform bill has had a very positive impact on premium cost. However, attributing that drop directly to changes in the medical liability law gets more difficult. Premiums began a sharp upward trend in 2001 and peaked in 2005, but then began to decline, even before the law change. From 2005 to 2011, for example, total premiums collected had already decreased nearly 30%. Comparing premiums collected year to year shows that a trend simply continued rather than the 2011 law drastically affecting premium rates. A flawed notion. Another common argument in favor of reform held that doctors feared they could be sued out of business with one wrong move. However, this argument also seems to be rooted in something other than historical fact, because such a small percentage of cases result in massive judgments. From 1998 through 2010, a jury verdict was reached in just 266 cases, or less than 4% of the cases that were filed in that same time period. Of those cases that resulted in a judgment, fewer than half awarded more than $500,000, and less than a quarter awarded $1 million or more. The largest three judgments were for $10.4 million, $8.1 million, and $7 million. The next highest verdict totaled $4.5 million, and no other verdict in the 13-year time span topped $2.4 million. Said another way, less than one-half of 1% of medical malpractice cases that were filed in more than a dozen years resulted in a verdict of more than the new cap of $500,000. To be sure, that figure does not include settlements reached out of court, which also can run in the millions. Medical Mutual pays on somewhere between 70 to 100 cases per year, according to Jenkins. From 2000 to 2010, Medical Mutual made 54 payments of $1 million or higher, a figure that includes both judgments and settlements. Of course, in a settlement, the physician and insurance carrier agree to the amount to be paid. Settlements that lead to voluntary dismissals have also steadily decreased through the years. From 299 in the 2011 to 2012 fiscal year to 144 in 2015 to 2016. Despite the exceedingly small number of large verdicts in North Carolina, Jenkins argues that the anxiety persisted among physicians. It was the fear of the personal assets at risk that was weighing so heavily on the healthcare community, specifically the physicians. It was definitely affecting the way they delivered care, and most importantly, the cost of delivering that care, he says. Even though the numbers were few, the ripple effect in the physician community was gut-wrenching. Matthew Ballou, an attorney at Zaytown Law, disagrees. Good doctors are not defining their practices by fear of lawsuits or so-called defensive medicine, he says. What drives them every day is a true concern for the welfare of their patients and doing whatever necessary to keep them safe from potential harm. That's the oath they took to uphold, and that's what they believe in. Furthermore, there are many industries in which a client may bring a lawsuit against a professional, attorneys included. Every profession has that same concern, Ballou says. I'm a lawyer. If we make a mistake, if we do something wrong at any time, one of our clients could file a suit against us. Benefits of CAP. Jenkins, Seligson, and other supporters of the changes argue that capping non-economic damages does nothing to directly keep anyone harmed by a medical malpractice from coming to court. Indeed, non-economic damages, meaning those for lost wages or lost future earnings, are still uncapped. Therefore, a verdict could indeed run into the millions if, for example, the victim is the chief executive of a Fortune 500 company who cannot return to a big salary. If, on the other hand, the victim is a stay-at-home parent or a disabled child, there are no lost earnings because the victim was not employed. In these cases, the non-economic damages, sometimes referred to as compensation for pain and suffering, are the only avenue for compensation is on the non-economic side. Costs for bringing medical malpractice cases can quickly run into the six figures, and attorney's fees can run between 33% and 40% of a verdict. From a simple financial viewpoint, the reality is that fewer victims of malpractice, particularly those on the bottom rungs of the economic ladder, see any benefit from bringing a lawsuit. Even finding representation can be difficult. In nearly every case, the plaintiff's lawyer will front the money to bring a case and cover costs and fees only if they are successful. Because of the cap, fewer attorneys are willing to take on cases. What does that say about plaintiff's lawyers? Jenkins asked rhetorically. Attorneys who represent victims say it doesn't reflect their character that they don't take cases, but the simple economics of the matter. After all, it would be an unwise business move to spend $600,000 to bring a case in which the damages are capped at $500,000. The impact of the cap falls disproportionately on patients with minimal wage losses, including children, homemakers, the disabled, and the elderly, says Burton Craig, an attorney in the Raleigh office of Patterson Harkavy. When the cap is added to the expense and risk of pursuing any malpractice case, lawyers are compelled to reject many meritorious claims with low economic damages. In the past decade, physician and insurance groups have succeeded in passing these so-called tort reforms in many states. In North Carolina, the clock isn't likely to turn back. I don't perceive any way, with the legislature as currently composed, that there would be a change to protect victims' rights, says John Allen Jones, the founding member and managing partner of Raleigh law firm Martin & Jones. Any bill introduced would be dead on arrival. Taking a step back, attorneys who represent victims say that physician and insurance groups have been successful in enacting law changes throughout the nation, in part because they can perpetuate an argument in short sound bites that the public can understand. Phrases like tort reform or frivolous lawsuits make for good television ads, but explaining how these reforms have affected victims is more nuanced and difficult to convey in 30 seconds. Already, the courts have multiple checkpoints in which a case that has no merits would be thrown out. The idea that a patient can file a frivolous lawsuit in a medical malpractice case and trick the defense, trick the judge, trick 12 jurors, and trick the entire court system into giving them a big verdict is a complete myth. It's a myth, says Ballou. No lawyer that I know files frivolous lawsuits. If anyone did, they wouldn't be practicing law for very long. And along with this article, there's a shorter section under Weeding Out Lawsuits with the headline, Frivolous Lawsuit? Probably not. In some medical circles, there lived a fear that one frivolous lawsuit against a physician could ruin that physician's practice. In reality, however, the North Carolina court system already has in place procedures to weed out complaints that have no merit. The following are legal motions available to any defense in a medical malpractice lawsuit. Motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6. The defense can make this before a defendant even has to serve an answer to the plaintiff's lawsuit. Motion for summary judgment under Rule 56. The defense can make this before a defendant ever has to go to trial. Motion for a directed verdict under Rule 50. The defense can make this after the plaintiff finishes their evidence at trial, but before a defendant ever has to put on a single piece of evidence. Motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict also, under Rule 50. The defense can make this motion asking for a favorable judgment be entered in its favor after a jury has unanimously agreed that plaintiff has proven their case and rendered a verdict. Motion for new trial under Rule 59. Once again, after the defense loses completely at trial, because the jury and the trial judge agree with the jury's verdict, that the jury's verdict should stand against them, they can file a motion asking for a totally new trial because they allege some injustice happened during the trial. The defense also always has the right to file a notice of appeal and ask the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and if that fails, the North Carolina Supreme Court, to overturn the plaintiff's case entirely. In addition to these legal procedures specific to medical malpractice cases, the plaintiff must find a physician expert who has similar practice to the defendant to certify under oath, before the complaint is filed, that the expert has reviewed, quote, all medical records pertaining to the alleged negligence that are available to the plaintiff after reasonable inquiry, unquote, and will testify in court if needed. In addition, the attorney representing the plaintiff must also certify under Rule 11 of the Rules of Civil Procedure that the filing is made in good faith and not frivolous. The lawyer could face sanctions from the court if the case is found to be frivolous and could even put the lawyer's license in jeopardy. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The main headline, Wolfpack gets ready to rock Reynolds again. Talking with Debbie Yao, the athletics director of NC State University, it is clear that Wolfpack Nation cannot wait for September 16 to arrive. That's the date the university will unveil the $35 million Reynolds Coliseum renovation to the public. The arena originally opened in 1949. The university is hosting a gala that night and inviting boosters, educators, and prominent Wolfpack alumni, government and business leaders to the event. But what is not very well known is that the university also will unveil a 7-year-old project to remember and commemorate the 4 most prominent basketball coaches in the university's history: Everett Case, Jim Valvano, Norm Sloan, and Kay Yao. Former student body president Andy Walsh is the person behind this Coach's Corner project, an unveiling of 6-foot bronze statues of the 4 coaches. The project became one of the cornerstone elements of the student body's vision of making our campus aesthetically appealing and somewhat unique, Walsh says. More than 45 artists from across the nation offered their services for these statues, and only 2 were selected, Benjamin Victor for Valvano and Case, and Tyson Snow for Yao and Sloan. Project leaders raised $220,000 for the 4 statues, most of which came from more than 20 former Wolfpack basketball players and program benefactors. I am thrilled to be a part of the unveiling of this important renovation and Coach's Corner project, says Debbie Yao. NCSU has a storied history when it comes to basketball, and what could be a better way to showcase our culture, legacy, and mission, all driven by the constituent we serve, the student body. September 16 also will feature the induction of the class of 2016 into the NC State Athletic Hall of Fame, led by the 1974 NCAA Men's Basketball Champions. Bikes selling quickly as Fly the Cyclery heads into final days in Raleigh. The bicycles are selling quickly at Fly the Cyclery as the longtime Raleigh business prepares to shut down. That's Flythe Cyclery. Ed Flythe opened the store in 1946 and his son Skip took over in 1970. Flythe Cyclery is right off Peace and near the Peace Capitol intersection that is about to have a massive transformation. Next spring, the city and state will be replacing the 66-year-old Peace Street Bridge and revamping the intersection. New developments are coming as well. Given the disruption ahead, Skip Flythe, 68, decided to close the business. His son Wynn died suddenly nearly 3 years ago, and there was no clear heir for the store. This has come to an end, Flythe says. Flythe says the store sold 150 bikes in a week in the sale, way up from a dozen a week it was selling, and only had about 26 adult bikes left as of August 17. A place to horse around in style. A barn that dates to the early 1930s and is considered historic is for sale in Wake Forest, and it's not just any barn, but one that stood on the farm of wealthy Durham philanthropist John Sprunt Hill. The Wakefield barn is a whopping 15,000 square feet with 24 stalls. The barn is part of an 11.2-acre property listed at $1.8 million. The property also includes other buildings, including one that has that has 2,600 square feet of living space upstairs. Phil Clausen of Coldwell Banker Advantage is listing the property. Clausen says the next owner could convert the property to private stables, use it as a commercial enterprise, or even develop the 11 acres. The property is on the National Register of Historic Places and qualifies for tax abatements, Clausen says. Small business gets big push August 20 in Raleigh. Want to learn more about small businesses? You can August 20 when the North Carolina Small Business and Community Expo is held at the NC State Fairgrounds. The expo is from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Exposition Center. Melanie Paul of the Business Alliance of North Carolina calls the expo a great networking and marketing opportunity for small businesses throughout the state. The expo includes speakers, performances, even entertainment for children. Authors Alexandra Lett of Sanford and Diana Needham of Chapel Hill will hold a discussion at 1 p.m. Was it here to get some North Carolina barbecue? One of the world's largest planes was at Raleigh-Durham International Airport this month. A Russian plane dubbed the Antonov AN-225 landed on the runway August 11. It's a Russian cargo plane picking up cargo for a client, explains airport spokesman Andrew Sawyer. While he doesn't have details on who the client is or what the cargo was, he does say the plane visits about twice a year, and it definitely makes an impression on the runway. Shops join the fun at Restaurant Week. Downtown Raleigh Restaurant Week is underway this week, and the 8th annual celebration has expanded to include other businesses this year. On the night of August 19, many businesses in downtown Raleigh staying open till 9 p.m. so patrons can browse their wares during Restaurant Week. Stacy Simone, Director of Marketing for the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, said that as the Restaurant Week has grown, organizers also wanted to find a way to showcase other businesses growing downtown. More than 45 restaurants are involved in Restaurant Week, which runs through August 21. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline: Sprouts Farmers Market breaks ground at new Raleigh Retail Center. Grocery store arrives in Raleigh in early 2017. The developer and construction contractor at the site of the new Olive Park Retail Center on Falls of Neuse Road in North Raleigh have brought in two block mason crews to fast-track the building project in order to open the area's first Sprouts Farmers Market grocery store by first quarter 2017. Officially, a Sprouts representative is still not confirming the deal to open a store next year in Raleigh, even though signage at the construction site identifies Sprouts as the anchor tenant. The spokesman said the company doesn't typically announce a new store project until it begins hiring for the store about 4 months prior to the opening date. Sprouts is a Phoenix-based specialty grocery store chain that has been targeting expansion opportunities across the Southeast. The 65,620-square-foot Olive Park project will be located at 9444 Falls of Neuse Road at the intersection of Litchford Road, adjacent to the new BB&T Bank building. Raleigh-based D&N Development is the project owner and developer. Other tenants at Olive Park will include the area's third Bad Daddy's Burger Bar with an outdoor rooftop dining space, a city barbecue restaurant, Chronic Tacos, Papa Murphy's Pizza, Supercuts, and Lee Spa Nails. Modernist home in Chapel Hill, once owned by James Taylor's family, sells to New York couple for $1.66 million. A Manhattan couple known as major art benefactors in both the Northeast and in North Carolina has emerged as the highest bidder for the boyhood home of Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter James Taylor in Chapel Hill. The auction in late June for the 7-bedroom modernist-style house on Morgan Creek Road had caught the eye and the attention of dozens of art and architecture enthusiasts when the house was opened up for public tours for the first time. But details of its sale had been kept sealed until the closing, August 9. The new owners of the house are James Keith J.K. Brown and Eric Diefenbach of New York, according to county records. The records also show that Brown and Diefenbach paid $1.66 million to the family that had bought it from the Taylor family in the 1970s. which was about $120,000 more than the property's previous listing price. Neither Brown nor Dieffenbach responded to requests for comment, but auctioneer Sarah Sonke of Auction First said shortly after the close of the auction that the buyers intended to restore the modernist home and preserve its 24 acres along the banks of Morgan Creek. July home sales slower in Triangle. Although the pace of home sales in July slowed in the Triangle compared to previous months, up a negligible 0.1%, closings so far in August are already up 22% over last year. Closed sales last year, July 2015, 3,516. July 2016, 3,520. Median sales price last year, $220,000. This year, $237,000. Average sale price, July 2015, $260,000. July 2016, $279,000. And average days on market in July 2015, it was 51. July 2016, 41. Sam's Club expands, will anchor Caveness Farms in Wake Forest. Wholesale club operator Sam's Club will open its first new store in the Triangle region in the past 7 years when its new store off of Capitol Boulevard in Wake Forest opened September 1. The club's fuel station opened August 17. The new store, located at 11360 Royal Cotton Road, will anchor the shops at Caveness Farms Retail Center. La Madeleine to open second Triangle location in North Raleigh. La Madeleine, the country French-inspired cafe and restaurant that opened its first location in North Carolina at Cary Town Center in July, will be opening a second location at Plantation Point on Old Wake Forest Road in North Raleigh. The restaurant will be opening in the former Mimi's Cafe building, but no official date has been set for opening. And now we move on to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. His main headline, Aetna leaving Obamacare marketplace in North Carolina. North Carolinians looking to buy subsidized health care through the Affordable Care Act exchanges will be left with limited options now that Aetna will leave the marketplace. What's more, it is possible that not even residents of all counties will have that option, as Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina has said it might scale back its offerings. Aetna Chairman and CEO Mark Bertolini announced on the morning of August 15 that the insurer would pull out of many markets where it sold Obamacare plans, including North Carolina and South Carolina. While Aetna, which sold plans in North Carolina under the banner Coventry Healthcare of the Carolinas, does not break out state-by-state enrollment figures, it held about 10% of the individual market in North Carolina with $330 million in direct premiums written. Aetna acquired Coventry Healthcare in 2013. The individual market includes more than just ACA plans, however. Blue Cross Blue Shield NC is by far the largest player in North Carolina's individual market, with 4 out of every 5 individual plans belonging to the insurer, and more than $2.5 billion in direct premiums written just in the individual market. UnitedHealthcare, which announced in April it would pull out of ACA plans, held 7% market share with $221 million in direct premiums written in North Carolina. For the insurance carriers, it comes down to profits and losses, and those who buy coverage through the ACA marketplace have consistently brought higher costs. Following a thorough business review and in light of a second quarter pre-tax loss of $200 million and total pre-tax losses of more than $430 million since January 2014 in our individual products, we have decided to reduce our individual public exchange presence in 2017, which will limit our financial exposure moving forward, Bertolini said in a statement. And next to this article, we have a He Said It quote. The quote, I am shocked and disappointed that Aetna and its executives have chosen to abandon their exchange members. We at the North Carolina Department of Insurance were in the middle of reviewing Aetna's rate request for 2017. Never during the review did the company indicate any concern that the requested rates would not solve. I am angered by the impact Aetna's decision will have on Tar Heel families and our market. That's from Wayne Goodwin, North Carolina Insurance Commissioner, in response to Aetna's decision to pull out of North Carolina's ACA marketplace. Durham's BioCryst begins new drug trial to target rare disorder that causes swelling. Durham drug developer BioCryst Pharmaceuticals has dosed the first patient in a new trial targeting a rare disease, a positive step for a company still recovering from a failed drug trial earlier this year. The new trial is called APEX-1 and is a Phase 2 trial testing an experimental drug's ability to treat hereditary angioedema, or HAE, a rare disorder that causes swelling, including in the hands, feet, face, and airway. This is actually BioCryst's second attempt to treat the disease after its first failed. BioCryst disclosed in February the results of the failed drug trial and recently announced it would discontinue development on the first drug called Avarostat. This second drug, identified by number as BCX7353, has shown early indications that it might work better. A Phase 1 trial showed good positive results, and BioCryst management is hopeful that the APEX-1 trial follows suit. Avarostat failed in a Phase 2 trial, so if results from APEX-1 are positive, BCX7353 would be further developed than Avarostat. UNC looks to help children who are battling peanut allergies. Researchers at the UNC School of Medicine say they are nearing a breakthrough in treating peanut allergy. Results from a clinical trial of 40 peanut allergic children found that almost 80% of participants achieved sustained unresponsiveness even when eating peanuts weeks after treatment. These are the strongest responses ever recorded. These findings, if confirmed in larger studies, could transform the care of peanut allergic children early in life, said Dr. Brian Vickery, lead investigator of the trial and assistant professor of pediatrics at UNC Chapel Hill. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, $15 million raised by Research Triangle Park-based precision medicine developer Metabolon. The company has now raised $80 million in six rounds of funding. And $45 million granted from the Golden Leaf Foundation to NC State University to build a new research facility for the North Carolina Plant Sciences Initiative. Halifax County faced fierce fight for a swellac plant. That's the headline on the first article on the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. Delve into the emails of economic development execs, and it's clear Indian manufacturer Swellac Energy's decision to locate a solar cell manufacturing plant in eastern North Carolina came after a lengthy behind-the-scenes brawl with Virginia. Halifax County in North Carolina had competition from Virginia, which had offered an incentive package worth $2.1 million for the project, codenamed Project Sunshine, according to North Carolina Commerce Department records released in response to a public records request. But commerce officials started their scramble early, with emails between economic development officials and the North Carolina Community College system brainstorming ways to recruit the firm as early as February 10. In a May 5 letter from Halifax County Commission Chairman Vernon Bryant and Halifax County Executive Director Kathy Scott marked confidential, officials unveil a plan more comprehensive than just a cash carrot. In the letter, the county pledges to work with agencies such as Halifax Community College, NC State University, North Carolina Solar Energy Association, and the Center for Energy Education and other organizations to create beneficial alliances with Swellect. Commerce records show Halifax County may have been the clincher for Swellect, agreeing to construct a 55,000-square-foot building worth $1.2 million over a five-year incentive period in order to match the state's One North Carolina Fund grant of $600,000. Technically, it will lease the space to Swellac for $1 per year, and the company will have to pay a fair market lease rate if it fails to deliver on its jobs and investment promises. Swelect will be the first company in the Halifax Corporate Park. The county, according to an application its officials filed with the state, hopes that Swelect will help stimulate other opportunities at the park and in nearby Halifax. And it's also estimated to generate nearly $350,000 in additional ad valorem tax revenues to the county over the next decade. Letters to and from state officials in the months leading up to the mid-June announcement also reveal new details about what exactly Swelect Energy Systems, formerly known as Numeric Power Systems, will be doing in Halifax County. In a memo to Mary Mae Johnson from Paul Jordan, it's explained that the company will imprint the glass and silicone with the circuitry, but will not manufacture wafers or thin film silicone at the site. The Halifax County facility will assemble glass and circuitry to form a solar cell. Panels will then be soldered from those cells, an automated process, and those assemblies will be tested, packaged, and shipped from the site. The folks constructing the cells will have an average annual wage of $30,419, and they'll have training support, as the state's package also itemized $186,000 in customized training. Mammoth Data files Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Durham-based Mammoth Data, previously known as Open Software Integrators, has filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection. At its peak, Mammoth employed about 30 people and cleared about $4 million in revenue, company president Andrew Oliver said in an email. Oliver founded the software consulting firm 8 years ago when he left Red Hat's JBoss. Mammoth Data now lists its total liabilities at about $500,000 and its assets at under $50,000. From the start, the company didn't sell product but focused on providing professional services to clients, he says, pointing to training and consulting contracts. Most years we were really successful. While Mammoth Data's marketing efforts continue to yield promising opportunity, the deals just aren't closing fast enough to keep the company viable. The 11 employees were notified early last month, he says, adding that he's joined another firm. According to the filing, the company owes money for credit cards, computer subscriptions, and loans. Creditors include insiders such as Oliver, who is listed as being owed nearly $88,000 in expense reimbursements and an installment loan. Elizabeth Edmiston, listed as the company's vice president of engineering, claims nearly $33,000 in an installment loan in the filing. According to the petition, Oliver and Edmiston were paid salaries of about $95,000 and $112,000, respectively. LED startup takes a new look at lamps. An LED startup with Cree roots is raising cash and carry, prepping to debut a table lamp its CEO hopes will be a game changer in the competitive lighting industry. Neeraj Lal, a former product marketing manager at Durham LED giant Cree, started Cary-based Perulum 2 years ago. The company, still technically in stealth mode, he says, is leveraging components from his old employer in new programmable LED lamps. Lal says he is working on the final design to push into production. The firm, which currently consists just of Lal, is trying to raise $600,000 according to a securities filing. So far, the firm has raised $250,000 of the sum from 9 investors via a mixture of debt and options, mostly friends and family, he says. The technology he's developing is customizable to individual preferences, activities, or moods with the touch of a finger, according to a product description. The first product, a table lamp, has two LED light sources working together to provide what Purilum characterizes as a uniform, omnidirectional lighting experience that can be customized by the user. And under a section called Still Weighing, Xylem, spelled X-Y-L-E-M, the New York water meter technology firm that confirmed a $1.7 billion buyout proposal of Sensus on August 15, is still evaluating what the deal could mean for the Raleigh-based smart meter firm. On a conference call following the announcement, Xylem CEO Patrick Decker told analysts the two companies had a tremendous cultural fit. The deal is really about the research and development capabilities of Sensus, he says, which makes leveraging the company's combined R&D systems a top priority. But he wouldn't say what synergies might exist regarding headcount. Obviously, we'll have more to share as we get deeper into the integration plan, Decker says, adding that a team has already been tapped and will be led by Xylem Interim Chief Financial Officer Shashank Patel. Suffice it to say, we're going to do things the right way and the smart way and not create disruption in either organization going after the last dollar of synergy. Sensus has 3,000 employees across the globe. Sensus, by the numbers, $837 million, adjusted revenue in fiscal 2016, $159 million, adjusted earnings before interest in fiscal 2016, 24, the percentage of Sensus revenue that comes from sales to electric and gas utilities, 70, the percentage of Sensus revenue generated in the United States. And now we turn to A Better World page written by Todd Cohen, who is also the publisher of Philanthropy North Carolina. And his column has a headline, Nonprofit Targets Early Learning in North Carolina. By the year 2020, 2 in 3 jobs in North Carolina are expected to require higher education. Yet in 2015, only 38% of fourth graders in the state and only 25% of fourth graders eligible for lunch that is either free or at a reduced price in school scored at or above proficiency in reading in their end-of-grade tests from third grade. Third-grade reading is the single greatest predictor of high school graduation and career success, says Tracy Zimmerman, executive director of the North Carolina Early Childhood Foundation. Yet, with the state's low reading proficiency numbers, she says, we will not have the workforce. Formed in 2013, the foundation works to support the development of children from birth to age 8. Its work has focused on engaging leaders from a broad range of fields, assembling experts to assess research and developing metrics to gauge the impact on third grade reading of policies in the areas of health, family, and high quality child care and education. Now, the foundation is forming 3 teams to use metrics its volunteer experts have developed on health, family, and high-quality learning, and to identify early childhood trends. Then it will create design teams to develop strategies and priorities for what makes sense for the state. With $325,000 from the Duke Endowment in Charlotte, the foundation is launching a Birth to 8 Policy Center to be a resource hub. The center will examine the policies and practices that have shown success in improving third-grade reading and will educate leaders and early childhood professionals. The foundation aims to help stimulate investment in early childhood education by building public will, aligning action around common measures, and advancing policy and practices to support those common measures, Zimmerman says. According to a poll the foundation commissioned in 2014, majorities of Democratic, Republican, and Independent voters in the state support investment in early childhood programs, and 83% believe investments in early childhood programs would benefit the state's economy. We know from research that during children's first 8 years, their brain is literally forming, and the foundation for learning is being built, she says. We also know that how the brain is built and how the foundation is formed is based on the experiences they have and the environments in which they interact. For optimal development, children need health and development on track. They need supported and supportive families and communities and high-quality birth to eight early learning, Zimmerman says. When we do that, she says, then we as a society get the best outcomes in education, health, and economic well-being for everyone. And in nonprofit news, Group to Renovate Chapel Hill Homes, Rebuilding Together of the Triangle will host the 2016 Capacity Corps Program Orientation, which trains AmeriCorps members for rebuilding together on a national level in Chapel Hill. During this event, nearly 45 Capacity Corps members participated in two build days on August 15 and 16, renovating the homes of local community members in need based on individual health and safety assessments. Bulls lend a hand in fight against cancer. The Durham Bulls hosted the Field of Hope game August 13 to join in the fight against women's cancers. The game was sponsored by UNC Cancer Care and UNC Rex Cancer Care, and proceeds benefited the Kay Yao Cancer Fund. Bike Challenge aids Hurricanes charity. Raleigh Orthopedic Clinic hosts its sixth 24-hour bike challenge to support the Carolina Hurricanes Kids and Community Foundation. The event, held August 19 through 20, includes a corporate division for the first time. Team members rotate shifts so that at least one person is riding a stationary bicycle at all times for the complete 24-hour challenge. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice column. And this one features Zena Howard. The headline, She Took the Lead on New National Museum. And this question and answer column was written by Amanda Hoyle. For much of the past 10 years, architect Zena Howard's life has been consumed by directing the design of the new $540 million National Museum of African American History and Culture. With the museum opening on September 24, Howard, a principal in the Durham office of the Perkins Will, reflects on her time as senior project manager directing a design team with representatives from 31 different firms and its communications with the Smithsonian Institute. What are your absolute favorite places or features inside or outside the building? One of my favorite places is the view of the Washington Monument framed by the military exhibit lens on the third floor. Another special place is the panoramic view of the Washington Monument grounds as seen from the fourth floor west balcony. So much of the design for the new National African American Museum of History and Culture was created by a team made up of many members from the three primary design firms. But for which pieces of the new building can you take personal credit? Although my role requires a broad level of involvement across all aspects and phases of the design, my firm had a particular focus on design and development of the above-grade interior spaces. I was more intimately involved with the detailing of the grand monumental stair at the north atrium, the glass orientation theater at the main entry level, and interior millwork, particularly at the main entry level. Why do you think you were chosen to be the senior project manager? Well, this critical role of leading a project of this scale, complexity, and political sensitivity requires experience, patience, resiliency, and a healthy sense of humor. I believe I was chosen for these reasons as well as my strong and authentic communication ability and style. I value collaborative, inclusive processes and strong relationships with clients, consultants, and colleagues. I'm passionate in my belief that equally important to what we do is how we do it, and that in the end, success is all about people working well together. What was one of the biggest challenges you faced with this project? One of the biggest challenges with this project was managing the impact of the extremely fast-track project delivery method and the decision, after the start of construction, to excavate nearly 70 more feet to expand the below-grade history gallery. These were very difficult and challenging decisions to make, but were the right choices in order to meet the project requirements. We overcame these challenges by first having a realistic view and understanding of the potential risks associated with these decisions. Difficult decisions were ultimately successful by engaging all key stakeholders, allowing everyone to have a voice and listening carefully, particularly to those who you may initially disagree with. I've learned that when you are at the vortex of seemingly competing interests and disparate opinions, it is critical to first seek the common ground and build consensus from there. When did you know that you wanted to become an architect? Around the age of 8 to 9 years old, I enjoy the creation of spaces, both internal and external, that serve and promote human interaction and experiences. You are one of a relatively few black women in the field of architecture in the U.S. Do you feel there is extra pressure on you to be a role model for a next generation of black women architects? Yes, I do feel that there is an obligation to be a role model, particularly for underrepresented persons in this profession. However, I don't consider this pressure, rather more of a duty and an honor. The advice I would give to other aspiring young architects is to stay committed to this profession, which can often seem difficult. Associate yourselves with work that is meaningful and strengthens our communities. Value the process of creating and the relationships that are built throughout. What do you think of this new museum? What do you think this new museum will best symbolize? Perseverance and resiliency, not just of African Americans, but of all Americans. There are many reasons why African Americans should not exist today as a viable and thriving community of people. But the stories of countless individuals, named and some unnamed, reinforce incredible accomplishments that can be realized when people work together toward common goals. Before this museum project, what was your favorite design project? The Anacostia Neighborhood Library in Washington, D.C. This is a place for learning and sharing in a community full of children that had long been without a library. What project is next on your agenda? I'm currently working on the expansion of the Motown Museum in Detroit. This project commemorates the history and continuing legacy of Berry Gordy and the Motown artists and sound. Equally exciting is the upcoming Brooklyn Village project that we were recently awarded. This is the redevelopment of nearly 17 acres in the heart of downtown Charlotte. What is something people don't know about you? If I wasn't an architect, I would be an urban designer. Also, I love action movies. And along with the article, there's also a box called Closer Look with information. Name, Zena Howard, age 50. Title, Principal and Co-Market Leader of Civic and Cultural Group at the Perkins and Will Design Firm. Hometown, Pampa, Texas, birthplace. Baltimore, Syracuse, New York, Rocky Mount. Residence, Cary. Family, fourth child of five children. Four girls, one boy. Education, BS in Architecture, University of Virginia. Hobbies, reading, planting, gardening, travel, church activities, jogging. What was your first job growing up? Babysitting and then coaching soccer. And we also have some general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. Rise Biscuits Donuts expands in North Carolina again. Rise Biscuits Donuts is opening in Friendly Center in Greensboro. The Durham-based business is going into a newly constructed 15,000-square-foot building with Pieology, a make-your-own pizza restaurant, and West Elm, a Brooklyn, New York-based furniture and accessory store. The building faces West Friendly Avenue and is flanked by Whole Foods and the Apple Store. Rise, which offers breakfast and lunch options, is scheduled to open in November. The business is co-owned by Rick Robinson and Ken Priest, and was named one of Fast Casual's top 100 movers and shakers. Founded in 2012, Rise has 7 locations in the Triangle, with stores coming in Charlotte and Wilmington. Rise is open from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. daily, with a menu that includes a variety of biscuits and donuts. Publix sets September opening date for its new Triangle store. Publix Supermarkets Incorporated has announced a September 7 opening date for what will be the grocery retail company's third grocery store in the Triangle. The new store is located at the Shops at Heritage Village at 1030 Forestville Road at the intersection with Rogers Road on the south side of the Heritage Golf Community in Wake Forest. Construction of the new Publix-anchored Shops at Heritage Village in Wake Forest was well underway as of August 8, 2016. The store will open to customers at 7 a.m. on September 7. The new store is across from the Harris Teeter Shopping Center at Heritage Station, which recently expanded. Florida-based Publix Supermarkets opened its first grocery store in the Triangle in 2013 at the Bradford Development at the corner of Davis Drive and High House Road in Cary. It opened its second Triangle store in May at the Mill Pond Village Shopping Center. The grocery has also confirmed plans to open future new store locations on Olive Chapel Road, Apex, and at Amberley Village in Cary. And that article is written by Amanda Hoyle. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the Viewpoint page and read as much as we can of the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, McCrory Visit May Offer Clarity for Local Businesses. We know very few of us doubt that this year is shaping up to be one of the most interesting, sickening, embarrassing, and mouth-watering election years in recent times. While presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have sucked up almost all of the oxygen for North Carolinians, there is another race on the card that most likely will be closer than the presidential race, and that's the election to choose our next governor. Sitting Governor Pat McCrory graciously accepted our invitation to come and take questions from the business audience on August 26 at an event in Cary. In addition, editors of our sister publications in Charlotte and the Triad also will be on stage with me to ask the governor to provide clarity on some of the pressing business issues of the day. We invited McCrory's challenger, Roy Cooper, to be with us at the event, but his team declined the invitation. For McCrory, these elections may determine whether he really is a fighter. He has slid in polls in recent weeks, a trend that may have more to do with Trump's decline in popularity than McCrory's positions. To the business community, taxes matter. To the business community, labor skills matter. To the business community, incentives matter. And finally, to the business community, equality matters, whether it has to do with race, gender, and sexual preference, or with income imbalance. McCrory must find ways to address each of these issues with clarity. For example, we keep hearing from his Commerce Secretary and current State Budget Director that HB2 has had minimal effect on job recruitment. Really? You think you will feel the impact within 5 months of the law being enacted? Wrong. The right question for McCrory's team would be to ask the economic developers whether site visits have dropped and initial interest has waned. Those things are forward-looking action. Maybe the numbers would show the effect is minimal, but we need to see those numbers. As I have written before in this space, our statewide economic development policy is flawed. We are trying to sell the entire state when corporations that are considering relocations are only interested in urban areas with public transportation, density, and a wide variety of arts and entertainment amenities for their workers. It would be interesting to see what McCrory thinks of a shift in economic development policy. And we'll stop there, just mentioning the governor will be at the Power Breakfast on August 26th. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.